Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist. The Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee. We have our head coach, Chad Zimmerman, with us.
Hey, everybody.
We also have, oh goodness, I'm going to read off the name because I'm going to mess it up. Hand Up Plus the Black Bibs Racing's Ivy Audrain. Good to have you back, Ivy.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been a minute. Glad to be back.
So Ivy's joining us on the road. She's in the middle of her cyclocross season. So her audio is going to sound different than normal. We tried getting a microphone in time and then shipping happened and it got delayed. So bear with us with that. And then with Chad, for some reason, Chad, we started a little bit late today. Chad's internet is just giving him fits today. So let's hope everybody listening, say prayers, do whatever else you do, knock on wood, to keep Chad with us, because Chad might end up cutting out partway through. We've got a great deep dive and we want to cover it. And Ivy and I are not going to fill those shoes. So if Chad drops out, yeah, that'll work great. If Chad drops off, deep dive to be continued at another date. Ivy and I are just going to talk about cyclocross and that'll be great. A couple things though. First of all, this is episode 339. Crazy. Lots of episodes. Pretty cool. Since 2015, we've been going with this podcast, helping people, and we love it. And if you find value in this podcast, the best thing you could do is share this podcast with others and go check out trainerroad.com. So please do that. Adaptive training is now live. A lot of people are using it. They're already seeing benefits, even though it's only been a little over 2 weeks now since people have seen it. They're already seeing their training adapt. And they're getting those adaptations. The workout failures are decreasing. It's fantastic. So super exciting times. Go check it out. Everybody, whenever you sign up for Trainer Road, there's no extra cost with it or anything. It's just how Trainer Road works now. You have adaptive training. You can use Train Now if you don't want to commit to a plan, or you can just look at the workouts with a whole lot more context because of adaptive training now. It's really good stuff. So check it out. And then listen to our Successful Athletes podcast. We have one coming up next week with an athlete. His name is Rodney Scrimshire. He's based out of Washington. Fantastic guy who talks about how this is super. This is probably relatable to a lot of listeners. From 2015, basically, until now, he's had the same two main goals every year, and he's just chipped away at getting better at them every year. He got second last year in his category at Lodajaw, and the first time he did it, he was like, I wonder if I can even finish it. That's a 200-mile race that we've talked about plenty of times on the podcast, from Logan, Utah to Jackson, Wyoming. And then a TT series that's super cool and innovative. Anyways, it's a really interesting discussion because we talk about how he improved week after week. And prior to that, Connor Wilson, the episode we did the prior week, we're getting a ton of feedback on that one. He's at 5.2 watts per kilogram, and I don't think his ceiling is anywhere near in sight. He's just raising up even more. Really exciting episode talking with him. So check that out, Successful Athletes Podcast. There's links down below. Share the podcast with your friends and go check out trainerroad.com. Okay, with that, Ivy, let's talk about your cyclocross season, because you're kind of like, you've been on the opposite schedule as so many of us, where in the summer you weren't racing at your, that wasn't the peak of your season. Instead, now is the peak of your season. So, first of all, have you met podcast listeners at the races?
Yes, quite a few. Well, I hear a lot of them on the sidelines and then, they say, oh, I love you on the podcast, and they're cheering and it's great. And then I'm like, oh man, I hope they come say, hey, after the race, and then they disappear. I don't know. So I've only met a couple, and I love meeting podcast listeners. So if you are at any of the races the rest of the season, please don't be afraid to come say, hey, I'm nice. I'm not like, who hurt you? Like, who has traumatized these podcast listeners to be afraid to come say, hey, please come say, hey, it's awesome meeting you guys.
Yeah. Ivy is one of the more approachable pro athletes that you'll find in the paddock. She's just, Ivy likes to have a good time. And good chats. She won't say no to a bubbly water after the race. Good times. So, all right. I want to talk about this. So early in the season, you were struggling. You weren't satisfied with your results, because building up to the races, you were like flying and you were doing really well. Your training was going fantastic. You were nailing your marks. How'd you handle that? Like going to those first few, because this is relatable for a lot of listeners. You go into the season and then you're struggling more than you thought. So how did you mentally manage all that?
Not well, at first. it was really bad. To be honest, I think the biggest struggle was just like being kind to myself. And, the reality was I'm the kind of racer that really needs to race into fitness. And those kinds of race efforts, especially with cross, like are really hard to duplicate outside of like a controlled race setting with other racers, like with, you know, 40 some other bike racers and like starting at the back. And you just can't emulate it, especially like the mental aspect of having to be like, all right, it's random call ups. I'm at the back. Like, got to try to get up there. Like, you can't, it's hard to practice that until race day. So I wasn't very kind to myself for the first few blocks or first few races in the block. And I luckily have a lot of great peers that I race with and a lot of good mentors that helped me focus on some process goals, less results-based goals that have kind of helped me change my perspective a little bit. And as a result, having more fun and getting better results and feeling better about it.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. It's kind of funny, right, Chad, how fun always tends to coincide with improvement. And I know it's like a chicken or egg sort of thing, but if you can adopt that mindset beforehand, it seems to really better your odds, right?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to enjoy a race when you're just struggling or you don't have confidence in your capabilities or, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we talk about like mud? And because you had some really muddy races and you live in Montana, you're from Montana. That's, mm-hmm. And I don't know if you have, like for us, we just don't ride in the mud here, whether we're wusses or it's because the clay is just so bad in our region that you really can't ride in it if it's wet. Do you have a lot of experience riding in the mud and did that catch you off guard or, and because you've done well actually in some of the mud races this year.
Yeah. And especially coming from my road background, I didn't think that riding in the mud was my time to shine. I don't know. But yeah, we like the other racers and I were talking about like those conditions are like impossible to emulate as well. You can't just go find like, especially once it gets starts getting ridden in, and like a big part of those courses is not just like riding on a wet course. It's how the course rides after like all of the other hundreds of racers have ridden on it all day and like how it gets packed in, and you can't practice those things, you know? So I think riding in the mud a little bit for me, I think practicing riding in the sand helped me a lot. Once you like make that connection of finding the balance of like letting go of your bike and letting it steer itself a little bit while still being in control, so much of that is riding in sand. And I think it applies pretty directly to riding in mud. So I think that's why I did well on those days, because I practiced riding in the sand quite a bit being in Sacramento. And that's like one of the more easily findable features to practice. So, I mean, also part of it was just being fed up with not doing well and just being like, all right, today's, we got to do it. Like, I just got to go. Yeah. The combination of those things. Good part of riding in mud too is like, I'm not very prideful in knowing like when I'm going too slow, it's just time to get off and run. You know, I don't like muscle things out just for the sake of being like, well, you can ride it. Doesn't mean that you should, like you're still moving slowly, or not as quickly as you should. And momentum when you're riding in mud or sand or technical conditions is so important in cyclocross. And I think I did a pretty good job of knowing when to call it and just get off my bike. And there was a lot of running in those races, but it worked out.
Mm. Can we also cover a bit of like the dissonance that exists between what a lot of us assume cyclocross pacing is like versus what it is like? And this might vary for you. Just speaking with like Tobin Orton Blod and speaking with other like cyclocross racers that are really good. Courtney McFadden is another example of one that we've spoken with, that they say that it's less punch all out coast, punch all out coast. And it's more like in the beginning of the race, yes, it can be like that, but then it kind of settles in at like a constant pace. Is it less stochastic like that, Ivy? And is it more stable than we might think in terms of what your pacing is like throughout a race?
I think that completely depends upon the course, what kind of rider you are, where you're starting. Like for someone like Tobin or someone that's starting on the front row and you're never racing around more than like three or four people at a given time because you have a really good start and you're on the front row. And once that A group goes, like they're just gone and it's just a few of them. Like of course, it's more like even, you know, you're just like racing a few people. You guys are the front of the race. You don't have any like real ground to make up. You're watching each other, like staying smooth is the most, or like the most advantageous way for them to ride versus someone that's like starting at the back and seeing all these disconnected groups of three and four riders ahead of you. You oftentimes have to decide when to like get out of the saddle and when to punch it and then when to chill in order to make up ground. If you're just like riding steady, you can end up dragging a whole bunch of people around. That other group will get away from you. It totally depends upon what kind of rider you are, where you're positioned in the race, and how to capitalize on those things.
So the majority of racers are not in that position that you talked about where it's like, cool, I'm going to be one of the riders that dictates the pace at the front of the small group. The majority of us are the ones that are part of the fragmented shrapnel behind them.
Fighting for our lives.
Yeah. And that's why you have to train that ability in cyclocross, right? That's why you have to be able to do off and on. Also, like a lot of courses, depending on your threshold and depending on your skills and ability to maintain speed, a lot of courses are simply going to force you to go really hard for like repeated times over the course of a lap.
Yeah. And a lot of the course features too don't really allow you to like stay stable and mellow. Like the folks making the courses are getting creative and it's like pretty cruel actually. But yeah, that's a big part of it too, is it's sometimes impossible just to like keep it steady. You just have to expend more energy and be able to react and settle in and not let it impact your race too much when you have to burn a big match.
Mm. So something I found during Cape Epic, I'm such a creature of habit and we had to like move accommodations and it really like, it was chaotic and they weren't in place and then they were in place and then they weren't in place and we had to find a plan B, and that sort of stuff really throws me off. Now I look at your situation though, and actually I did this during that time and I was like, oh wow, like I need to not complain, because Ivy's just been on the road for a long time living in host housing and then joining up with certain riders and then joining up with other riders depending on the race and who's going to be there. How do you not let all that stuff affect you in terms of just like, because your circumstances are constantly changing, yet you're expecting yourself, or hoping at least, that you can perform consistently well at all these races, but everything else is changing. Is there anything that you've found to help kind of help you perform on race day in a consistent manner, even though everything else is changing?
I'm still figuring that out, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, being, like a cyclocross orphan and, I don't know if like folks know this, not really like traveling and having multiple bikes and like multiple sets of wheels and all this equipment. Like it's not like rolling up to a summer crit or like traveling to like a crit in the summer where you could travel with a backpack. Like it's crazy, all the logistics surrounding it. And there's so many of us racing this year that like we have our sponsors and we're professionals, but we're on our own. And having to like work together and team together to travel to and from all these races across the country. And it's tricky and complicated and feeling displaced and trying to like work on my hotspot in a van on a weekly basis. Like all of it really takes a toll. And I'm still trying to figure out how to not let that stuff get to me too much and how to still prioritize taking care of myself and making sure that I'm eating and sleeping when I should. And yeah, I still haven't figured out completely how to not take it all into the race day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone has tips, fire in my way, please.
Yeah, I don't have any tips for it. Chad, have you, I mean, you did plenty of racing where you were, you know, traveling around to different races and doing that sort of stuff with teams. I don't know if you have any tips that you've found over the years.
No, we always had pretty cush accommodations and everything was structured pretty nicely. I had the good fortune of racing on teams that they were masters teams almost always. In fact, they always were. So they had the benefit of experience, connections. So most things went smoothly. It was quite nice. But this does remind me, I would often watch Jeremy Powers and I'm trying to think of Tim Johnson and even Stephen Hyde, you know, guys who are super strong in the United States, and they travel over to Europe and they kind of get spanked. And a lot of the times I would hear them in interviews talk about how difficult it was to manage all the unfamiliarities and all these logistical challenges that Ivy's describing, and then still have to put their game faces on and be completely ready to give 100% when 100% just isn't available. I mean, you know, 10, 15% of it, whatever it is, has been siphoned off by these minor challenges that don't really even have anything to do with bike racing.
Mm. Yeah, it's a big challenge. I think that's, you know, that might be why you see the playing field a bit more leveled when cross country Olympic rounds come over to the U.S. It doesn't seem like they're quite as they still dominate in most cases, but they're not quite as dominant perhaps as other ones like that. I don't know. Yeah, it is tough. It's absolutely something to consider. Brandon, you should talk to Brandon and Sophia. They seemed like they were completely unbothered by the entire situation when we were at Cape Epic. Like, Brandon could just do anything. It doesn't matter if they told him that he had to sleep even without a tent that night, he'd figure it out. It would work just fine. He'd still be climbing at like 5.5 watts per kilo. So,
I need to figure out how to just be like generally more unbothered, I think, is the
more
trick.
Chill.
Yeah. But like, yeah. I was talking to some folks about like process goals in cross and like trying to have fun, and you should have fun. Like with any discipline of racing, like you should try to have fun, but you still have to care a little bit. Like, obviously, like,
for sure.
You're still a competitor and you're still there to compete. And so it's like with all this stuff about like being in transit and being displaced and not being able to like sleep well and like eat enough, and like you still have to care about that stuff because it still really matters. So you can't like totally disassociate and pretend that it doesn't matter, because it does. And so maybe that's why I'm having a hard time, is because those things do matter, but how do I be zen and chill about it?
It's yeah.
Yeah. I feel bad that I don't have better advice.
Hey, transparency is extremely valuable too, because somebody else is thinking that they're the only ones that struggle with this. And this is helping somebody when they traveled to that one big race that they did this year and they just didn't feel like they had everything in place and they didn't perform well. Well, you're not the only one. Like, it happens to Ivy. It happens to everybody at the highest levels down to the lowest levels of the sport. It's what it is, what it is. It's a struggle. So I'm just excited to have you racing this season. That like, it's just fun. I love seeing your stuff on Instagram. You should follow Ivy on Instagram, by the way. Go check her out. Cindy can cheer her on throughout her cyclocross race season. Is your goal to go to, we have Worlds over here this year, or I should say next year. Is your goal to try to qualify for that? I don't know how many riders we're fielding and even what that process is like.
Yeah, that's a little out of reach for me, John.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
That's okay. Yeah. For the World Cups too, as US as the host, we could have 12 riders. And so that was a early season goal for me, to be in the top 12 in the US to be able to go to those. But it's a crazy fast year. Like, we're talking about it the other day, but like any position of riders between like 5th place and 25th place can change in any which direction, like on the same weekend, like between 2 days. Like, it's just a really fast year and everyone's really, really capable. Worlds is not a goal at this time. I'd be sick to go. I might go and drink beer and high five people, but that's probably it. Yeah.
Part of me wants to go to that too. That would be fun to go see cycle. I mean, when a world championship comes to your country, I know the US is a big country, but still, it'd be cool to go for sure. Mm-hmm. Chad, let's get into your deep dive. What do you say? It really kind of comes from a question from Drew. You good with that one? Oh yeah. Chad's having a lot of technical difficulties.
Yeah. I think from what it sounds like, it might be going around. So are we going to deal with this now, or should I launch into this?
Let's just try to launch in and let's see what we can do.
Okay.
Let's drop the clutch and go wide open. Okay. I'm going to read Drew's Drew's question. He says, what's Coach Chad's experience around exercise induced hypoalgesia? I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I apologize if I'm not. He says, I know he's not a doctor, and he has a little trademark thing after that. trademark from Chad Timmerman. He says, but I'm curious about his thoughts and feel like he'd appreciate the topic. After even a single hard FTP interval, I feel a very distinct internal, and he says this in quotes, blanket of numbness under my skin that can persist for up to 2 hours after a ride concludes. No sensation is diminished but pain. As a chronic pain sufferer, could this reaction mean incorporating 10 minutes at threshold might actually give me an advantage in punchier, more painful races? This is a really interesting question that could go a lot of different directions, mm-hmm. Chad. In which direction has the research led you?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question, and it's kind of a layered one. And what's especially interesting is how astute Drew's observations are. I don't know if he's dug into research literature at all, but some of what he says is so in line with what the literature has sussed out that makes me wonder if he's. I think he's speaking from a place of knowledge. Otherwise, he's just really good at guessing. So, what I'm going to do is to try to cover or broach three topics here. First is our influence over pain is multifaceted. Secondly, I want to look at sufferers of chronic pain and make it clear that they commonly utilize exercise to manage pain. This is nothing new. And then thirdly, just discuss the multiple types of exercise that can lead to reductions in pain, because there are a few kinds and it's probably not limited to just those. So to begin, let's just talk about pain in general. And you've probably heard the term pain is in the brain, and that's it's accurate. And because it's in the brain, it means we have the potential to steer into very, very deep waters here. And I want to manage that depth because this is a huge topic and I can't possibly do it justice with the, you know, handful of days I devoted to researching it and the time that we're going to spend on it just now. So I'm going to try to keep it all endurance sport relevant. And then I'll also limit it or include a bit with regards to chronic pain. In terms of pain itself, I did read a particular paper on the topic, and I highly recommend it because I think it was the most interesting paper I read, just in a general sense, a general pain sense, from 2007 by Irene Tracy and Patrick Mantis, and it was in the journal Neuron. In a nutshell, they make clear how impactful neuroimaging's inception was on granting us insights into pain perception. Because I mean, everything prior to that had to be somewhat, if not entirely, theoretical. And now you can actually do things to people, look at imaging, see what's happening to different parts of the brain, how much activity is going on, et cetera. So that in and of itself is interesting. But what's especially interesting are a number of points were actually kind of stood out within this paper. First of which is pretty basic, and it's just a differentiation between chronic pain and acute pain. Chronic being, at least by European definition, pain that persists for more than 3 months. And this being a European paper, they brought up that roughly 20% of the European adult population is affected by some form of chronic pain. Coincidentally, I was reading an article this morning that talked about chronic pain in the United States and said 1 in 5 people are affected. So that number seems to carry across the pond. And given that is, you know, 15 years ago, I don't know if it still stands up, but it probably hasn't improved, I would guess. That's on the chronic side of things. On the acute side of things, it's more quick onset and then quick relief, right? It comes and it goes, and it's just, it is what it is. So you can almost see these two things as the difference between disease versus symptom, right? Disease and chronic pain, I believe, is considered widely a disease, whereas acute pain is just symptomatic of some underlying issue or pathology or injury, whatever it may be. Another point that was interesting from this paper was that pain is not necessarily linearly related to its cause, and the cause is termed a nociceptive input. So a pain perception input. And to further that, the response to pain is affected by what's appropriate or possible was the term they use, which already shines a light on the fact that there's some subjectivity to this, right? We can decide what's appropriate. We can, within our own context, determine what's possible and move forward accordingly or deal with the pain accordingly. There was a figure in it that I found especially interesting because it described pain with factors that amplify, attenuate, and color the pain experience, which again points to the subjectivity of this, that this is something we can affect. So then the question becomes how? And there really are a number of ways. On the behavioral side, anything from anxiety, so just anxiety in a general sense. You know, if you're already anxious for whatever reason, it can increase your, you know, hypersensitivity, your sensitivity to pain. And then there's pain sensitivity. Or I'm sorry, pain anxiety, pain related. So just the idea of the pain that's coming creates its own anxiety. So, you know, we've all gotten, or, you know, for those of us who have gotten COVID vaccinations, just knowing I'm going in and someone's going to put a needle in my arm can create some pain related anxiety that might influence your perception of that painful experience, right? Your mental state. So depression has an impact on how we feel pain. Cognition, you know, how sharp are you today? How well are you thinking? And in terms of cognition, I think of how my RPE is on a workout that I've done 100 times. You know, how well did I sleep last night? How cognitively functional am I today? Because the sharper I am, the easier it is for me to deal with that workout's discomfort. And then your personal beliefs can also influence it. In all of this, I kind of encapsulate into just the single more general word, your disposition. What's your disposition? And all of these things can alter this pain experience. And then I came across a paper from just last year by Buckingham and Richardson that talked about optimism and grit as moderators of what? Resilience. Because they saw resilience as a positive mechanism in managing this pain experience. And I think all of us can agree on that. And what I found especially interesting is they described it as an adaptive trait, and that word is what stood out to me because it's something that, you know, changes with time and experience, an adaptive trait that results in an ability to sustain effective physical and psychological functioning during stressful events, such as experiencing pain, right? So again, something it's a bit within our control. A pilot study back in 2017 looked at ultramarathoners and noted that they, by and large, have supranormal pain tolerance. And that in and of itself is interesting. Endurance athletes being tough is news to nobody, but it's nice to see a study that shines a light on it. But they attributed it to some especially interesting things. One is that they experience less pain-related anxiety. So they're already good with it. They know it's going to hurt. And all of us as bike racers should totally be able to relate to this too. We know going into it, this isn't going to be a walk in the park. I mean, unless you're me and you decide you're going to just get there when you get there and you're not racing it, you know it's going to hurt. The second thing they attributed to of a few things was elevated pain tolerance due in part to the reduced avoidance of pain. So they're not seeking to avoid it. Rather, it's more of an accepting attitude than an avoiding one. And that's terribly interesting. Problem is, and they point this out, is it's kind of a chicken or the egg scenario. Is it endurance, you know, ultramarathoners cultivate a high pain tolerance through their training, or do people with high pain tolerance gravitate towards challenges like ultramarathons? Who knows? I don't know how you would even determine that. And then as Drew pointed out, he used the term hypoalgesia, which let's break that down really quickly. Hypo being low, algesia, sensitivity to pain. So we're talking about low sensitivity to pain, and this can be brought on in a number of ways, obviously through drugs and painkillers, analgesics, and familiarity with stress. That's an interesting one. I mean, it's just having experienced something one time can alter your perception of it the next time. Placebo, which is always fun to talk about, but in this case, it really makes it clear pain is where? It's in the brain. I mean, if we can just take a sugar pill and decide that it's a painkiller and feel better because of it, well, it's obviously there's some central mediation going on there, and exercise. And this is especially interesting because exercise, something we're going to do anyways, can actually affect the pain experience. So I've used the term pain experience a couple times, so let's discuss it in particular. But in doing so, I want to look at a couple of the more endurance sport relevant aspects of the pain experience. The first of which is a term I saw quite a lot. And man, I've linked to, I don't know how many studies over the course of this deep dive, and there are tens, if not hundreds more. This is a huge topic. And this term in particular, conditioned pain modulation, cropped up a lot. And basically, it's just the diminishing of the perception of pain intensity following some form of conditioning. Okay, so to put that another way, you expose yourself to some form of pain, you do something, and then you repeat that exposure, and there's a change in your perception of the pain that second time around, okay? In line with that is something termed descending pain modulation, and this is just the pathway starting from the brain, translating to and through the spinal cord onto what's called your trigeminal sensory system. And to say that the pain is in the brain is obviously simplistic, but it might be a little more accurate, but still simplistic to say that pain is interpreted in the brain, because at some point, we have to have sensory input, right? We have to get it from somewhere, whether we feel it, see it, smell it, taste it. I mean, we have to get And I say this not knowing, there may be something that's fully contained in the brain. I can't speak to that. But by and large, we need sensory input in order to respond to it. So this trigeminal perception helps us interpret all forms of input, warm, cold, intensity, pain. It's the pathway that allows us to alter our perception of sensory stimuli. It allows us to kind of define, is this less painful, is this more painful? And this brings us to what all of this is building towards so far, two terms, facilitation and inhibition. Now, facilitation is pro-nociceptive. It leads to the perception of pain, whereas inhibition is anti-nociceptive. It leads to the blocking of the detection of pain, okay? So I hope you see where I'm going with this. Before I continue, though, into the research, I want to talk about how researchers and us can quantify pain, how we can quantify pain. So let's call it pain metrics. I mean, we're in the business of performance metrics. Now we're going to look at pain metrics for a short while. There are different types of pain, basically, or there are different sensations that can be associated with pain. So we can look at heat, for instance, cold, for instance, pressure, and that's the deep muscular tissue sensitivity. So by and large, us on the bike, pressure is what we're describing. It's pain in the muscles. Yes, we deal with heat. That's more on the thermal side of things. I can't even wrap my brain around that. So we're just going to look at pressure pain, pain pressure. Which brings us to pain thresholds. So you may have heard the term pain pressure threshold. This is one. This is the pain threshold that relates to pressure. And the pain threshold is simply the lowest intensity that's perceived as painful. So you feel pressure to a point where eventually it registers as painful. And this is generally, there's a good consensus across individuals. So where one person agrees, you know, that they do cold, what's it called, pressure. I'm not sure if that's what it's called, but basically they submerge their hands in cold water until they perceive that as painful. So when one person puts their hand in cold water, it's pretty much a consistent temperature across individuals that says, yep, that's painfully cold. Now, so that's more on the objective side. Pain tolerance, however, is more on the subjective side. It has to deal with how much you can stand. So put your hand in that same cold water. How long can you tolerate it? What is your interpretation of the situation? How miserable is it for you? And what's even more interesting about this is how very malleable our interpretation of pain is. And why? Again, because it's in the brain. And this brings me back to just a minor anecdote here, a little diversion. So much of us in our youths and even later in life go through a martial arts phase. And I went through mine in the 90s. And I had a couple of buddies. One friend of a friend was actually the sensei. He was the guy who was the black belt in Taekwondo, the black belt in Jiu-Jitsu. And we're at the community center and we're taking classes from him, but we're also buddies. So we also hang out on the weekends. And no alcohol involved. Just some nights we just decide submission wrestling is the thing that we're going to do. So basically, it's MMA, but well before MMA was as popular or prevalent as it is these days. And we would wrestle until basically either made your buddy pass out or tap out, right? I mean, that's just the nature of it. No punching or anything, just wrestling. But I would get Pat, he was the sensei, the bad mofo. I would get him in a headlock and I know he was fading and I would just have to hope, wait it out. And he would grab my rib cage, grab the flesh on my rib cage and just dig his fingers into it. And it worked like a charm. Every time he would do that, I'm off him. I mean, it was extremely painful, but he had done that enough times and I had employed my same headlock tactic enough times that I knew it was coming this last time. And I said, nope, I'm going to work through it. And I held that headlock and he grabbed onto me just like I knew he was going to do. But I decided in that instance, I'm not going to let this be as painful as I've perceived it the past few times. And I held on. Sure enough, he had to tap out. So there's a
Chad,
true
this is the most wild example.
But I think I about it when I say, how can I tolerate this situation when I'm on the bike and I'm falling apart and I think, oh, I can't possibly do another interval. And it's experiences like that that tell me, yeah, you can decide right now, I can do this. Your body's not going to quit. You're not going to run out of oxygen. You've got enough glycogen in your muscles. You've got a gel sitting right there. All the excuses don't really hold up. So you're choosing to quit when you know that you can tough this out. Mm-hmm. Okay, so back on track. One more metric. There's a pain intensity rating, and this is really quite simple. It's just, you know, rate your pain on a 1 to 10, 1 to 20, 1 to 100 scale. And what's interesting about this is that it not only differs across subjects, but it differs within them. So one person may rate that cold water as a 6, another person may rate it as a 4 or an 8, whatever. And then that same person, under different circumstances, could rate it differently, right? So all of these things are important because they indicate that we have some level of influence on how we perceive pain. Okay. So all of this steers us to the question, what causes reductions in pain? And I'm just going to look at this briefly from two perspectives, one's physiologically and one's psychologically. So physiologically, we have an endogenous opioid system, which is responsible for the release of beta endorphins. And we did talk about this on the podcast, though. Geez, it had to be quite a long time ago. I don't even know if we were into the hundreds at that point, but it is out there. Alternatively, there are non-opioid systems within our body. Specifically, one of them is endocannabinoids. Then there are neurotransmitters like serotonin and norepinephrine and things of that nature. And it looks like, based on what I've read, that the exercise parameters kind of determine which system is tapped. For instance, the duration of the workout, the intensity of the work you're doing, is it continuous, is it intermittent, et cetera. Frankly, I'm not sure it matters which system is activated. The fact is, something brings us pain relief, and it happens physiologically. Psychologically, this is where I'm especially interested, is there's something called attention and distraction modulation. So we can effectively direct our focus. And if you think, I've heard this a number of times, I'm suspecting it's out in the wild. It's not just something that I'm privy to, but elite athletes focus on the pain, whereas non-elite athletes focus on anything but. And I don't know if that stands up. I'm sure there's plenty of middle ground there, and I'm sure there's plenty of time where elite athletes are focusing on anything but. So I don't know that that's the strongest of statements, but it conveys the idea. You can focus on the pain, or you can try to distract yourself from the pain. And if you've done any of the workouts with the workout text on, I mention this a lot. I say, you know, there are instances where focus on the pain, focus on getting through this last 30 seconds, embrace how this feels right now, versus other times where I try to suggest what I term productive distractions. You know, focus on something that takes your mind off the pain, but is still productive to what you're doing. You know, monitor your pedal stroke, or your position on the bike, or your eyes on the horizon, et cetera, that sort of thing. So, you know, grant your attention or try to distract yourself from the pain, or don't do either and just let the workout take the reins, because exercise can, in fact, reduce the perception of pain. And when it comes to chronic pain, this is something that is not news in any respect. This has been happening for, I was looking at articles from the 70s. So this has been a known thing for quite a long time. So let's kind of dive into how exercise can affect how we perceive pain. First of which, one interesting aspect is that there's general versus specific effects. And as you might expect, it's more pronounced in the exercising muscles than the non-exercising muscles. But there are studies that have shown effects on the painful muscle when a distant muscle is exercised. And this is important because it suggests that there's a peripheral as well as a central pain inhibitory processes in place. So there's stuff going on in the muscle, but there's also things that are mediated by the brain that can affect the body in a more general sense. Then when it comes to the types of exercise that can induce this hypoalgesic response, the research leans specifically or quite often on three types: aerobic exercise, isometric exercise, which is where you hold the contraction, but the angle of the joint doesn't change. So just, you know, like a plank, for instance. And then dynamic resistance, which is, it's a whole lot of movement without movement. So the joint angle doesn't change, but there's all sorts of muscular activity. So it's like standing on a Bosu ball or an Air X pad or something where you're holding your balance and your body's pretty static, but there's quite a lot of activity taking place. So I'm only going to look at isometric and aerobic. First off, isometric across the board seems to elicit moderate to large effect sizes. And it does so through low to moderate intensity leaning toward longer durations. And the point here is that they try to push the muscles close to or actually to fatigue in order to elicit the greatest exercise-induced hypoalgesic response, the greatest reduction in pain in thanks to exercise. And it looks Like, according to most of what I read, that there's no apparent dose-response relationship. It's not as simple as just doing something high intensity and kicking back and waiting for the pain relief that should follow. Rather, it's attributed to recruitment of high-threshold muscle units, motor units. So basically, we have to get those fast-twitch fibers. And you can do that through high intensity, but you can also do it through low intensity with long duration. So you just wait, you just do it long enough. Hold that plank long enough to where your slow twitch muscles are fatigued, they tap out, and your fast twitch muscles start to be recruited. And this is what apparently increases the level of exercise-induced hypoalgesia. And this may not seem terribly relevant in our context, but it's certainly relevant when it comes to chronic pain sufferers. And Drew did ask the question with regards to this specific type of pain, these specific people. And as I mentioned earlier, exercise is widely considered an important component of effective chronic pain management. This is, again, not news at all, and isometrics might be the most beneficial way of going about it. So whether you suffer from just some examples, fibromyalgia syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, chronic low back pain, chronic musculoskeletal pain, shoulder myalgia, list goes on, it appears that engaging in moderate to high intensity aerobic work can actually push you to the other side of things toward hyperalgesia. So it can actually increase your pain. Not so, at least not as commonly, with the isometrics. In two studies that I looked at, one looked at fibromyalgia sufferers and noted that they preferred low intensity work, whether they worked at 45% versus 60 to 75% of max heart rate, and they had greater pain reduction at that lower end of things. They also had improved effect sizes, so better effects in terms of exercise-induced hypoalgesia when they used either their preferred intensity level or a doctor-prescribed moderate intensity level. So the point is lower side of things. Okay, but now let's talk about endurance athletes and look at the aerobic side of things, the aerobic exercise side of things. And specifically, almost every study I looked at was either cycling or running. And they noted that intensity definitely has an effect, whereas duration's effect is equivocal. So first, with respect to duration, one study did 1 by 10 versus 2 by 10 at about threshold and noticed that there was no difference in the diminishment of pain between those two. So the same effect after 2 by 10 as 1 by 10. Another study looked at 10 minutes versus 30 minutes, and they noticed no difference in the pain reduction with the 10-minute effort, but when they extended it to 30 minutes, significant difference. So again, kind of equivocal when it comes to duration, so I'm not sure there's a heck of a lot of value in focusing specifically on the duration of your aerobic work. Rather, on the intensity side of things, there is a clear dose-response relationship across a lot of different studies, and they lean toward the moderate to high intensities, noting that they elicit the greater exercise-induced hypoalgesic response. The largest effect sizes seem to happen right around 75% of VO2 max, which, you know, you equate that to FTP, it's in the ballpark of 90%. So we're in sweet spot, pushing towards threshold, much like Drew mentioned, and has to be carried out for 10 plus minutes, much like Drew mentioned. So that seems to be the sweet spot, and I'll come back to that. When they worked with low intensity cycling, 10 minutes at 50% of threshold, VO2 max, which put us, you know, 60, 65% of FTP, so endurance work, no significant change in pain ratings. 30 minutes at that same effort level, moderate effect size. And then when they did 10 minutes of high intensity training, small effect size. So the high intensity stuff, if not given enough quantity, didn't seem to have much of an effect. So to put all this another way, the most consistently reliable exercise form for exercise-induced hypoalgesia seems to be in that moderately painful region. So basically what Drew said, threshold territory. The one study pointed out that there is a larger hypoalgesic response after painful versus non-painful, which I find pretty ironic in that you have to experience pain in order to lessen it. So you have to give a bit to get a bit. And I guess that kind of makes sense. I mean, you can't lessen pain if it's not there in the first place. But the fact is, you got to hurt a bit for your body to respond and make it hurt a little less. So what this shows us is that exercise-induced muscle pain may be tied to the magnitude of the exercise-induced hypoalgesia, but it's not likely the primary mechanism. And I say that because of another study that I came across that used non-painful exercise and still achieved some hypoalgesic response, in particular walking. Walking seems to be widely accepted, and especially for chronic pain sufferers, it is one of the most popular or effective ways to go. And then finally, let's just look at the post effects, because Drew mentioned that he has this blanket of pain that lasts for up to 2 hours after exercise. Couldn't really find anything to support that. Doesn't mean it's not real, but most things looked at the effects lasting maybe 15 minutes post, as long as 30 minutes. But when you start pushing up toward 30 minutes, it's a real trivial effect. And another study looked at the reduction in pain sensitivity lasting about 5 to 10 minutes post. So it doesn't seem to be a heck of a lot of support for the idea that work really hard, get this pain reduction flowing, and it's going to carry well past your workout. It's not to say it's not true. I couldn't come across any evidence of it, scientific evidence. So the overall takeaway here is that all three types of this exercise can demonstrate large effect sizes. Of course, it's transient, but they're all effective ways of going about it. And then finally, just to close out, there are a number of studies, 5, I'm going to be super quick with them, but they were all interesting and I think pertinent. There's some utility to each of these. First off, exercise-induced hypoalgesia appears to favor women, at least in some studies. So in one study I linked to touts more hypoalgesia in response to exercise for females, which, you know, whether it's real or not, placebo's real. So if you just believe I'm a woman, I get more pain relief from exercise, yay for you. There might be something there. Secondly, age has demonstrated an impact on the condition pain modulation. So as we age, it's kind of tough guy syndrome, right? And they talk about masters athletes being tougher, old guy strength, all that stuff. Well, maybe that has something to do with it. But fortunately, there's no change in exercise-induced hypoalgesia. So a lot of the literature pointed to the fact that as you age, that doesn't decrease. You still get the full benefit. One very interesting study was one on competition-induced analgesia. So, and this was, it kind of pointed out the difference between men and women, but I think more it pointed out the difference between psychological engagement, because they used a video game and experienced some level of hypoalgesia on the men's side. Women's side, not so much, but they reasoned that the women weren't particularly interested in playing video games, so they didn't get as competitively involved in it. What was interesting about this is it kind of shines a light on the fact that there might be a psychological end to things too. So psychological stress can actually bring about a hypoalgesic response. And then one talked about mirthful laughter, which, you know, we're not talking a chuckle or a guffaw. We're talking full-on laughing. They had people watch a comedy versus a documentary for 30 minutes. Laughed very hard and exerted favorable influences on pain tolerance, which I can't help but think when I sit down for my longer, sometimes sweet spot, sometimes VO2 max, and I'm reading, and that's the documentary side of things. So I'm probably making things quite a bit more unenjoyable than they can be. Whereas if I just sat and watched episodes of The Office, maybe I'd have a better workout. And then finally, even getting on the bike just to spin your legs carries benefits. We've talked about this before via the lymphatic drainage, but one study that used manual lymphatic drainage, so I think massage, actually increased pain threshold and pain tolerance, which leads me to posit that maybe exercise-induced lymphatic drainage, spinning your legs, is likely to have a similar effect.
Chad, that's all I got. Fantastic job to you and your internet. It made it through. Somehow, there were some rough patches, but we made it through. I was trying to not intervene at all. Yeah, I was trying to not intervene at all because I didn't want to throw you off, and it was working. Fantastic. So, I do have one question here, Chad. Based on the research that you've done, has your perspective shifted at all, or where do you stand on the common assumption that, kind of like what we talked about with Ivy, in the sense that you kind of need to race yourself into that ability to be able to express your full fitness, right? You show up the first race and it can be really tough. And it's this question of whether it's the fitness that you gain through that, or if it's your ability to be able to deal with that level of discomfort that's novel from the racing experience.
Yeah, that I really wanted to have a good answer for this. I wanted to be able to say, here's what to do to make that first ride of the season less painful or to be more competitive. And honestly, everything I've read makes me think there's still some fitness limitation there. You just haven't had to work as hard as you have to work when you're the one being, when you're following and not, you know, not directing, so to speak. There's just nothing that I was hoping that the after effects would be like days worth. Having some exposure to this means that next time your perception of the pain associated with it is diminished. And maybe there's something to that, but try as I might, I couldn't really find anything that backed up with research the point I really hoped to make. So I can't tell you.
Yeah, it'd be really tough to prove that, I bet, within like a research sort of a context, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't even know what you'd measure, because if it is, I've seen articles that claim that it's this the rush of endocannabinoids what's the other side, the opioid system, whatever, that it stays kind of at a higher baseline level, and then it's easier to ramp it back up. But again, I tried to dig into that a bit with the time that I had, and I couldn't find anything that made it a clear-cut case.
Yeah. Ivy, have you considered that very thing before too? Is like, maybe I'm just better at hurting now rather than fitter, like, you know?
Oh yeah, definitely. But I just can't like let go of the fact that Chad just said he reads on the trainer.
Oh yeah. And listens to classical like, music.
During intervals.
Yes.
Honestly, that nothing passes time like reading. The engagement I get by reading something that's mildly intellectually challenging, it can't be too difficult, makes the time just fly more than anything else, more than music, more than documentaries, more than comedies, whatever.
I'm impressed.
My ADD says no.
Yeah. This is something that, so whether another chicken or egg thing, I may create this every year going into the mm-hmm. race season, but I have noticed that once I get, and it's even, so like, it's even if I race a totally different type of racing, it's just getting used to that sort of pain and intensity, because my interval workouts are plenty hard. But racing is a unique type of pain because, you know, it's unexpected, it's novel, it's catching you off guard. There's a lot of different aspects to the discomfort that you're experiencing, because so much of it is psychological as well, you know?
Relevant to this conversation, I do think that stands up. So when we think about that conditioned pain modulation, that is that. But when you experience it in a very controlled, I won't say comfortable, but a very controlled environment on the trainer, you know what power you have to put out, you know how long you have to hang on to it, you know when recovery comes, and then you have to go out and you have to do all of those things, but you're not armed with any of that information. I think you have to have some exposure to that in order to condition that response.
Yeah, and even to believe that you can do it, that you'll make it through, right? Mm. Since you don't know what's coming up. Sorry, Ivy, I interrupted.
No, that's okay. I think you've talked about this in prior episodes too, when talking about like the confidence you carry when, I mean, we've talked about your needing the ability to suffer in order to get faster and like enjoying that process a little bit. But you've talked about like the confidence you carry from completing a really difficult workout or like in a specific zone that's really hard for you, and how that confidence can help you then in, now maybe what we know is conditioned pain modulation, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Completely.
Yeah. Super interesting stuff. And at the very least, one thing that, you know, whether endurance athletes already have this preconditioning on board or these increased capacities to be able to tolerate pain, or whether it just comes about from it, no doubt endurance athletes have a unique relationship with pain. In the sense that, you know, you get long periods of exposure to it for extended, you know, for quite a high percentage of your time, relatively speaking, to average folks. Thanks for doing all that research, Chad. Let's jump into some rapid-fire stuff.
Pleasure.
Sam says, quick rapid-fire question. Who is the rider on the app loading page in the POC Aero helmet? Would be nice to put a name to the face, seeing as I see the guy 3 or 4 times a week. You're looking at him. It's me. So yeah, that's me. We try to not use pictures of me because I'm kind of like a recognizable face on Trainer Row, but in that one, you can't tell because all you see is a big old egg-shaped arrow helmet. So but yeah, that's me. That's me on there. Good Easter egg. All right, Tom says, I'm 33 years old, have a resting heart rate of 44 and a max of 199. I train regularly and have raced at a reasonable level. Should I be worried about how high the max is? For context, I recently hit 198 for a minute on a ramp test, and I hit those numbers while training and racing fairly often, and I've been in this range forever, since I started cycling seriously 6 to 7 years ago. He mentioned also in this question that everyone around him is like, you're crazy, I can't believe your heart rate's that high. But nah, you shouldn't be worried about it if that's something that he regularly hits and he feels like there's no discomfort or anything else, right, Chad? That's just the way it is.
Yeah. I mean, and the fact that he can hold 198 for a minute says that's not his max. I mean, he can probably touch even higher than that, which just all points to the fact that he's got a really high heart rate reserve. So if you've seen that term HRR, it's the difference between your resting heart rate and your maximum heart rate. And his is massive, which says it, according to some, that he has the potential for or has very high cardiovascular fitness. So it's not a bad thing. And frankly, if you, it's nothing to fear. I mean, you're not going to, I don't want to say any more than that. It's nothing I'd worry about.
Yeah. And it's always important to remember the relationship between heart rate and stroke volume, right? And that those two things work together to deliver a certain amount of blood to your body. So, you know, it's, if a person has an extremely low heart rate and is listening to this and suddenly they're concerned because they're not high, well, maybe you have really high stroke volume, right? And so your heart doesn't have to beat like a little hummingbird. It can beat less just because it's outputting more blood per beat with higher stroke volume. Yeah, Yeah,
I've been at points in my cycling career where I can sit at 150 BPM and crank out 350 watts. So that's not a whole lot of heartbeats going on for that much power, which says my stroke volume at that point in time was obviously pretty massive. I can only imagine what with that stroke volume and 198 BPM. Ooh. speedy business.
No doubt. All right, let's get into some fun ones. Okay, Phil says, advice for a roadie transitioning to mountain biking. Ivy, can you take this one, having a past as a pro roadie and doing mountain bike races and stuff these days?
Yeah, for sure. I wonder what kind of mountain biking Phil wants to do, just like recreational, or if they want to like race XC or something. I think it's, you know, common for roadies to want to get into XC right away. Because they like climbing and they want to race and stuff. And so I have seen a lot of roadies like get short travel XC bikes right away. And those bikes are hard to ride, man. Like, like a hardtail. Or hardtails. Like you have to, you have to be like pretty tactful and thoughtful about the way you ride. You can't just like be a dumb cannonball all the time.
Very technically sound. It requires your technique to be perfect. Anytime that it is not, it is punished because there's less of a buffer between you and chaos, right?
Right. And we're not talking about like being punished, like not going as fast as you want to be going. We're talking about like crashing and potentially injuring yourself for those. So that said, I would advise Phil to start with something like an enduro bike, something with a lot of travel so that you have plenty of cushion to learn those really fundamental off-road skills before you decide what you want to do with mountain biking and like maybe get a fast bike, maybe get a hardtail, something that requires more skill. You want to have like a gentle buffer while you're learning those off-road skills, and something with a lot of travel is great for that.
Within the next 5 to 10 years, all of us will look at racing cross-country stuff on a hardtail as just crazy. So we'll all be on 120 mil travel or more, and that will be what it is. So don't think that you need to go with the most like rough, abusive, and uber efficient in terms of what you think it will be bike. Go for one that will, and it's all about strengths and weaknesses, right? You already have a ton of fitness probably. So you're coming over to this side where you have probably relative weakness of bike handling. So why not get a bike that really helps you figure out your weakness without punishing you so much that you're not even physically capable to do the activity, AKA injured. And then that way you'll be able to build up on those strengths over time. I think it's sound advice, Ivy. Good stuff. Thomas, Chad, you'll take this one first. If you could choose to win Kona or Cape Epic, which would you pick? Ooh.
Cape Epic. I think it's a bigger affair. Having to go hard for 8 days in a row to me is more impressive than burying yourself for a single day.
Yeah. Yeah. Ivy, what would you say?
Oh man, both of these just sound horrible to me.
To the cyclocross racer. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was like, I got to run. Like what? Yeah. swim. I'm not very buoyant. I'm going to say Cape Epic.
Due to lack of buoyancy. I would say.
Due to risk of death.
I would say Kona, because that seems like, I think it's just because I've done Cape Epic. And whenever I'm at Kona, I'm literally starstruck by all of the athletes that are doing that. Like, I just, it's so hard. Like those conditions, like Chad and I, one year we were having a pizza party in an air conditioned house watching the live stream with occasional bouts of jumping out into a pool and back. And then we sacrificed ourselves by driving down in an air conditioned car to the course. And we stood at the turnaround on the run course on Elite E Drive for like 30 minutes. And both of us were like, I'm sweating so much. This is so hot. I can't handle this. And we were just clapping for people. And we got back in the car and went back to the house. So like, it's so hard. I would say Kona to me is just such an impressive feat. Either one, or like, you know, I mean, just look at Jordan Saru. I have no clue if Jordan Saru, like what sort of level of fitness he carried into Cape Epic, but he was buckled day after day after day. You look at that finish line, he was destroyed. Like, and so that just shows that like that level of athlete, how hard that is, what they did. Also at the after party, we were at the after party celebration because Specialized destroyed it and they have a huge HQ there. So we went there for this after party and I think Jordan Saru ate like 6 entrees while he was there. He was just trying to make up for all that lost carbohydrate, I guess, over the whole course. So either one, but I would pick Kona. How much chamois cream is too much chamois cream? This is another question we got.
Any.
You're fine with anything, right, Chad? Whole bottle?
I'm just...
Whatever, Chad. Go
no,
read a book on it.
I'm saying...
Get out of here.
I'm saying chamois cream is unnecessary.
Yeah. I don't use chamois cream unless it's raining. So, and actually, I didn't use chamois cream on Cape Epic when it was raining, and I kind of wish I did because I finished 2 days where my chamois, which is usually bright green, was 100% brown. It's from the mud, I promise. And that thing through multiple washes has not changed. It was that much permeation of like mud and water and nastiness. So I don't use chamois cream typically, but I should have on those days because I was pretty sore after that. But not a lot. You don't need a lot. A little bit goes a long way, right? Like, I don't know, Ivy?
Like a nickel size.
Yes.
Yeah. Y'all, it's okay to use chamois cream. Jeez.
Yeah.
use more if you need it.
I've seen people just like put the bottle in the bibs and just dump that bottle in there and squeeze the whole thing out. And I can't imagine that would be comfortable, but I don't know.
Or
maybe.
Or if you like have, I've had teammates who like on a really bad saddle sore day will just like take their, like put their chamois inside out and just like, do like a scoop and start just like painting it on their chamois. Like
butter on toast.
I'm like, this ain't gonna, only God can help you now. This isn't gonna help you.
Like. Yeah. The squirt barrier balm I found is the favorite chamois cream that I've used. It has nothing to do with their chain lube. It's just like, it's almost, it's more similar to like a bag balm, but even then it's a little bit different. But a little bit goes a really long way. And that stuff does great with persisting through rainy, nasty conditions that you might be riding in. Because some chamois cream, if it gets wet, it just kind of goes away. So that's one way they can help. Okay. From Tobias. What job would each of you have if you never rode a bike? But here's the stipulation. The other hosts have to answer for you. We don't have to go for everybody. Just something comes in mind. So if we never rode bikes, Ivy, what would be our job? But you have to answer for us.
I didn't want to read the rapid fire before the podcast so that my responses were genuine, but now I'm getting like caught off guard.
Okay. I'll buy you some time, Ivy.
Okay. Okay.
Jonathan, you're going to be a social influencer. That's clear. And that's a profession these days. And Ivy, I don't know that, don't take this the wrong way, but I think you're going to be my favorite barista of all time. I just see you in a coffee shop, happy to be there, and someone I look forward to talking to every day.
I mean, I did work in the service industry. I waited tables for like almost 10 years. So it makes sense, actually.
All right. I got one for Ivy. You're a director of a nonprofit And that nonprofit focuses on helping people that are disadvantaged get access to something. I don't know. That's just Ivy's got big heart. It doesn't fit in the frame that we have here on Zoom. So I'd say that's where Ivy is. Chad would be a veterinarian, just like his fiance is, because Chad has a profound love for animals, if you don't know. And he is a caring and kind guy, and also is fascinated with how we as as living organisms work. Yeah. I think you'd be a vet, Chad. So I think, yeah.
Okay. I think, John would be a therapist, nice. Or would make a great therapist.
Nice.
At least he already like kind of is for me. And Chad, I would for sure put you in some sort of like high level college athletics coaching.
Ooh, yeah.
For awesome. Sure. As someone that's been in like, traditional sport college athletics before.
Mm-hmm.
Big, good coach vibes. Yeah.
Awesome.
Let's continue more of the good vibes. Michael asks, your favorite cycling memory? Oh,
I got one.
I've got one. You go first, Chad.
So I don't have a favorite, but I have favorites. And one of them was a local race series. It was the last race in the series. There was a close points race between me and second place. And I came into it needing to win all three preems and the victory. And I managed to do it. And I got what made it so special is I got support from people I wouldn't have expected it. No reason for them to help me out, not teammates. But for whatever reason, they liked me more than this other rider, or just, I don't know why, but it was support from unexpected places. And I delivered on something that seemed a very tall order at the start of the race.
Mm. I think, mine is probably when I was still racing road and my mom was still, Cat One. We were doing pretty big regional stage race, and she led me out to win the crit, and pretty much broke the entire women's pro field in the last lap too. And as my lead out person, I had to keep telling her like to back off, like easy, because she was riding me off her wheel. And she rode myself and like three or four other sprinters that were able to hold her wheel. And then there was like a time gap, like 10 seconds to the rest of the field or something. She was incredible. That's my favorite cycling memory, I think.
That's cool.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah. That's like a life goal right there. I think I have two that I want to separate. One of them is, I went to North Star, and, I don't know if this was legal, so take this for what it is, but went to North Star with one of those kids ride shotgun or Mac Rymore bike seats on my enduro bike with Simon. And we rode flow trails all day with my son, and he was just over 3 years old at that point. And we just ripped bike park laps all day, and he was just hooting and hollering as we went around awesome berms and went over jumps and stuff, and he was so happy. We didn't do anything big or crazy. Don't call CPS on me. It was small stuff, super fun, just enough to give him that weightlessness feeling. And that was like, an entire day of your kid just like grinning ear to ear and laughing while he's riding a bike with you. Yeah. Doesn't really get better than that. It was pretty amazing. And then the other one, even though it's, I don't know, I would say when I Everested with a group of close friends and like a really strong group of people that we all suffered really deeply, and it was terrible weather and everything else. And it was over 24 hours because of just many circumstances. And that one, I feel like there was a lot of bonding that went on the bike. And I recognized at that point, I think the power for the bike to be like this cool vehicle for bonding that could never happen otherwise. It was really cool. It's fantastic. I look back fondly at that. So, okay. Favorite film with a bike in it. This doesn't have to be a bike movie, just with a bike in it. Sam says
Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Amazing.
Mine would be, it's always a toss up between American Flyers and Breaking Away. Mm-hmm. However, got to give an honorable mention to Quicksilver, Kevin Bacon, yes. His heyday. It is so horribly cheesy, but I can't not watch that movie if I come across it.
Yeah. And if you're listening to this, Chris Reichert, Chris Reichert, Kevin Bacon, the same exact thing, actually, not separable. So, okay. I'm just going to pick a fringe one for you all. So Rad absolutely has to be up there. And I'm sure Chad is going, oh yeah, Rad probably is high up on the list. Maybe Ivy too. Yeah. But While You Were Sleeping with Sandra Bullock way back in the day, if you ever watched that movie, that one has one clip where a kid is riding a BMX bike, and poor kid, but a kid's riding a BMX bike. He's throwing out papers and I don't know if he hits a patch of ice or something, but he has the most spectacularly hilarious crash I think I've ever seen. So that one always sticks out in my mind. So go watch that one. You'll enjoy it. Okay. Go to cake choice at a cafe stop. And I assume cake is like just whatever baked goods they have. Yeah.
Lemon bar.
Ooh.
Lemon bar. Love me some lemon bars.
Yeah, that's good. Sometimes little key lime pies. Yeah, if they have them.
I would go with some sort of like a custard croissant, like something that, like a croissant with, that's really good with good, croissant with custard. So croissant. I have no clue. Is that how French people actually pronounce it? We all joke around.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We assume. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, <good. laughs> Don't want to make assumptions here. Okay. Is it acceptable to wear leg warmers without wearing arm warmers?
Absolutely not.
Okay, good. I'm not alone.
Absolutely not.
I can't imagine doing that. I would feel like undressed. And Chad's video is frozen and he just looks like he's not impressed. Chad, can you hear us? I don't know if you've officially dropped off.
Yeah, I can hear you guys.
We might.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, he's back. Okay. Okay. Yeah, we can hear you. What do you feel about this, Chad?
I was echoing Ivy as she said it. Absolutely not. In no world does that make sense. Why would you layer up your low body before your upper body? Not to mention, it just looks completely ridiculous.
Yet here I am in pants and a t-shirt, and I do that regularly. So now I'm questioning myself. I guess it's different on bikes. This next one. And I forgot to add in one word on it. Is it okay to do workouts with mismatched socks?
Sure.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, workouts.
It's what it, you know, if it's indoors, whatever, right? And even if you're outside, who cares?
Go crazy.
Yeah. I'm physically incapable of doing this. The socks have to be matching. They have to be perfectly at the right height and everything else. I personally can't not do that, but, you know, whatever. Okay. Meg says, what pro teams will have the best kits in 2022?
Oh, Keegan's team for sure.
Oh, they were cool this year, right? I like those.
Yeah.
Canyon SRAM is no longer going to be with Rafa. So I don't know what that means for their kits, but they've always had, I think, the coolest kits, the women's Canyon SRAM team. I think they've been the best kits out of the entire men's and women's pro peloton. So I don't know now that they're gone with them. Who's Rafa going to be with? I guess just EF. I don't know.
Just Keegan.
There we go. Just Keegan. Chad, do you have any strong thoughts on this either way?
I always look to EF to be the ones who push the envelope. It's either horribly ugly or horribly good looking, but it definitely is noteworthy.
Yeah. EF usually is the one that drives it. I like their black multicolored kit they had this year, like predominantly black with lots of other colors on it. That was good. Okay. From Wobbly Moose says, your favorite saddle. Ivy?
I definitely have a favorite saddle. My dear friend in Missoula, Montana makes my saddles for me. They're called Catahoula Ergonomics. Yeah. They're incredible and pretty unlike a lot of the saddle. If you're like me, you've tried like every saddle that's been made ever. And these ones seem to work for me. Like the cutout is just right. Like the slope of the nose is just right. The width on the pubic bones is just right, which is hard to get. And, I'm obsessed with them. Mm. He's going to be mad too that I'm saying this because he's also the guy, my friend Brian that makes them is also, a trail builder and works for our, local mountain bike association and is already really busy. And so he gets really upset when I tell people about the saddles, because then he's like, you're making more work for me, but they're really that great. Yeah.
Nice. Chad, what's your favorite saddle?
I can't think of what it's called. It's a specialized saddle. They have so many models, but it's the one that's obscenely pricey. It's like $450. It's made out of a honeycomb sort of mesh I can't remember what it's called, but that thing has been the single best saddle I've ever sat on.
A specialized mirror saddle, I think it's called.
Yeah, that's it.
Yep. Yeah. And mine's Pro Logo Dimension, the 143. That's the, yeah, that's the jam. I don't like the thicker one that's made for mountain biking. I don't know why you'd need a thicker saddle for mountain biking. Like, you have suspension and big old bumpy or big old balloon tires to help with that sort of stuff. I don't know. Yeah, that's what I like. Okay, let's get into some listener questions from Rose. She says, hey, Trainer Road Crew, I really enjoyed following the team's progress at Cape Epic. As my husband and I prepare to do a stage race as a team, watching the Cape Epic coverage has me wondering about the benefits of drafting or working with a team on a mountain bike. Sophia spoke about the advantages of being able to draft off of others in the race. The pro leaders seem to rely on this quite a bit. But I'm wondering how much of this is applicable to the average mountain biker such as myself. The pro racers are obviously going at much faster speeds where drafting will actually come into effect. But I also wonder how much of this is just a mental effect of trying to stay with the group or a true aerodynamic benefit. The race that we're working towards is the Pisgah stage race. There are plenty of gravel roads, but most of these gravel sections are steep and rough. I average about 6 to 8 miles an hour on these climbs. I also generally like to lead. I feel like I can ride more efficiently when I can set my own pace and see what's ahead of me clearly. But as the smaller rider of my team, I've heard plenty of people advise me to have my husband pull me whenever possible. And she says, pull in quotes. Since she's watched Cape Epic, she probably saw people literally like holding onto jersey pockets and getting pulled along and pulling someone along. And in this case, she's just talking about, you know, you pull at the front, which means you ride at the front. She isn't talking about the actual pulling. So as a non-roadie that hates to ride behind others, is this a skill I should develop to work more effectively as a team? Ivy, what would you say to this one? Being in cyclocross, like, you know, cyclocross is higher speed typically than mountain biking in terms of average speed, depending on the course, but it's still not road racing. So how do you view drafting?
Yeah, I think I should cover that there are advantages and disadvantages to drafting, both on the physical and the psychological side of being able to draft. So like, physically, there's obviously an advantage to drafting because you're saving energy, but also it depends upon like where you are in the race. Like Rose, if you're faster than your partner, but you decide to draft to save some energy, the leaders ahead of you could be getting away or like, you know, increasing their advantage on you and your partner, or you know, drafting into a technical section might not be the best move either. And there's a lot of tact in that with cyclocross and with other off-road disciplines where timing your draft and then passing in like before a technical section can be a huge advantage for you depending upon where you are with your technical skills. So yes, there's a physical advantage to drafting, but it can also be a detriment if you're not going the pace that you need to for the sake of drafting and conserving some energy. And then psychologically as well, I know you might be okay just being on the front. It sounds like you're okay just setting your pace, but there's also something very mentally restful about giving yourself a little break and letting someone else lead. That makes you feel a little bit more recharged and gives you a little more energy for a technical section later on. And just makes you feel like you're not doing the brunt of the work for the entire stage of the race. But there can be pitfalls there too, again, with letting like a group ahead of you gain momentum, or if your partner isn't pulling in the way that you'd like, it can kill some of your momentum for sure.
Yeah, I think it is totally an important skill to develop, right? Ivy, like if you're going to race as a team, be comfortable riding behind somebody. And the best cross-country racers are incredible to watch with this. And I bet it's the same with cyclocross racers. I just have never ridden with like, you know, the best of the best in that field. But it's incredible how they can ride so close through technical winding terrain and everything else. And they just are able to maintain. It's really, really impressive. It's a skill that has a lot of it just has to do with trust. And the second guessing just has you drag your brakes a little bit more frequently. You touch them or you hesitate coming into a section rather than just being able to fully trust. And you can't trust somebody you don't know. That's tough. So I don't expect you to go into this and to just say like, yeah, okay, just ride behind somebody and have it be perfect. So it does take time to build. Brandon and I were constantly trying to find somebody to ride behind, but then in spots where we felt like we needed to take advantage of strengths that we had, we would go to the front. So, and I assume in the Pisgah stage race, it'll be the same thing, but boy, what a technical race that will be. So I would think that you would want to play this so that depending on where you're at in the field, I mean, if you're at the front, you're all set. You don't have to worry about it. But depending on where you're at in the field, when you get onto those fire roads, that's when you'll want to allow yourself to kind of settle in. And if you have technical strengths, that's when you're going to want to get into position to be able to leverage those technical strengths later. But yeah, it takes a lot of time. And Brandon and I became much more trusting of Brandon's wheel over the course of that race. I bet he became more trustful of my wheel over the course of the race as well. It's just the more you ride with specific people, it happens. Like when I ride road with Chad, I just feel like I never have to offset from his wheel. You know how when you don't fully trust a person, you don't overlap wheels, but you kind of sit a few inches to the left or right of their tire. And when I'm with Chad, I just know, oh, no, I'm just right where it needs to be. He's not going to make any dumb moves. He's not going to hit anything bad. You know, we all have those riders. So yeah, it takes time. Damien says, good day. I'm just going to say that. I'm not going to try to emulate an accent. Damien says, my name is Damien and I'm a professional triathlete who has been doing sports for only 3 years. And in that time received my license. My question today is about weight management and eating. I roughly train for 26 to 30 hours per week, including three gym sessions. I assume those gym sessions are probably not longer than an hour, but I may be wrong there. My disciplines are Xterra and long course triathlon with a 4.8 watt per kilogram for insight if it helps. And it absolutely will, Damien, because I'm going to get into a lot of numbers later on. Damien says, I've stayed roughly around the 71 to 72 kilogram weight mark for the past 18 months, no matter how much I eat. I've been attempting to put myself into a surplus and push to 75 kilograms for the past 8 to 2 months with little gain. If anything, I've lost a kilo or so. He says, I'm 6'1", so a rather thin athlete. My average diet for a day would consist of breakfast being a large bowl of muesli and 2 bananas with a black coffee morning snack of, and he says black coffee and a morning snack of a salad, normally consisting of mainly greens and about 500 grams total. Lunch would be another large serving of vegetables such as sweet potato or rice or pasta with a protein shake with nuts, berries, and other fruits. So it sounds like he's getting good macronutrients, so that's good. He says, after snack would usually be 2 slices of toast with honey and peanut butter, and dinner being another large meal, carbohydrate-based meal, lasagna, pasta bake, or noodle-based dish again with a large quantity of vegetables. Then throughout the day, consuming carbs and training, which can range from 300 to 400 per day. I assume he's talking about grams of carbs. He says, I typically eat more than any of the other people I train with, and yet have no movement in my weight, even with the added strength program. So any tips on successfully adding mass that can contribute to being a more powerful athlete would be great. Always love hearing the podcast and can't wait for international travel to open up to shred the trails. Damien, thanks for sending in this question. Lots of detail, which is great in this case. So I want to get into the main goal of your question. Any tips on successfully adding mass that can contribute to being a more powerful athlete would be great. So we'll get to that. But first, we need to lay out some context to actually look at the numbers here. Because it's really easy to undernourish when you're an athlete that's training at the levels that you are training at. So, let's look at like physical demands just from a very basic general perspective. You're at 4.1 watts per kilogram and you are at 72 kilograms or 158 pounds and you have roughly, that should put you at like a 350 watt FTP. So let's assume that you have 15 hours on the bike and then about 12 hours split between run and swim, and then you make up the rest with your gym work. Typical training intensity of a pro athlete with an FTP of about 350 watts means you're likely burning somewhere around 4,000 calories a day from all three disciplines in your training. So, and that's just looking at basically the kilojoules that you would expend on the bike and then thinking of what you're probably doing on the running. The bike is where you're going to probably be burning more calories, especially with a 350 watt FTP. So 4,000 calories a day, that's just from the training that you're doing. Then let's add in your BME. So if you look at that, and assuming that you have a heightened metabolism of a professional athlete, like we're assuming, it's likely that you're averaging somewhere around 6,000 calories burned each day. So if you're fueling at 90 grams an hour while you're training, that still requires you to take in about 4,200 calories through food outside of training. So that's 4 meals of just over 1,000 calories each. And that's hard to do. Like try to eat 4 meals of 1,000 calories every day when you're eating like you are and, you know, macronutrient or micronutrient dense foods, and you're going to plants and you're going to all those things. Now, if you're just eating Oreos and everything else, you can probably knock that out with relative ease, right? But if you're trying to eat four meals of over 1,000 calories a day, that's pretty tough. So you can see how easy it is to undernourish. And you can get really specific on macros, but you can also just step back and look at the how much are you taking in and how much is coming out. And if you're not putting enough in, that means that it's going to be really tough for you to actually gain weight and put on desirable mass that's going to help you go faster on the bike. So with that in mind, keep in mind that if you're listening to this and you have a lower FTP, you probably won't be taking in that much. If you are not training almost 30 hours a week, you're probably not going to be needing to take in that much, right? So it's really different. But in this case, you can see you're burning a whole lot. Chad, I don't know if you have any thoughts before we get into the tips on the nutrition and other stuff for him, but any thoughts on anything that I've mentioned there?
Sure. I have a couple simple ones. The two things stand out. First, you're comparing yourself to other endurance athletes. Don't do that, because that doesn't mean anything. It's assuming that they're nourishing well, and my guess is they aren't, at least not sufficiently. Secondly, if you're looking to add mass, that's done through protein, plain and simple. It doesn't matter how many carbohydrates you eat. You're not going to add muscle mass if you're not ingesting enough protein. So everything you described in your daily caloric intake doesn't seem very heavy on the protein. I don't know what your protein shake consists of, but that's one bolus of protein. I would want to see more protein in not only each meal of the day, but in both of your snacks, so that you're getting anywhere between 20 to 30, maybe even on the higher side. You're not that big a guy. So probably 30 grams of protein, 3, 4, 5 times a day. If that doesn't add a little more mass to your frame, I don't know. Contact me and we'll personally sit down and figure this out. I'm not a nutritionist. I'm not a dietitian, but you are protein deficient, but based on what you've provided here.
Yeah, it sure seems that way, right? That's like number one, that you want to make sure that you're getting enough protein if you want to add mass and you simply can't seem to do so. It's also worth stating that if you're depriving yourself of carbohydrate on the bike, which you say that you're feeling it somewhere, if you're feeling it somewhere around like 70 grams per hour, I would actually call that underfueling for your threshold being at 350 watts. Like that's, you're outputting a lot of power. So if you are depriving yourself on the bike and then depriving yourself of carbohydrate later on, which it doesn't seem like you are, but if you are, this is a common thing, then that's only compounding the effect. So you want to be taking in that carbohydrate to make sure you're not just completely running yourself down and catabolizing. And then you also want to make sure that you're taking in that sort of protein that you need. And if you're trying to gain weight too, I would try to look at, if you're really going to measure things, I'd be looking at adding in somewhere, 250 to 350 calorie surplus that you're maintaining. Try to get that from healthy food, right? Don't try to be getting that from, don't pop a couple Oreos to hit that. Instead, look at what you're doing and just increase portions or, add in another small meal where you're going to take something in. Make sure you're taking in recovery nutrition right after your train or after your sessions, because with triathlon and going from one to the next, if you're doing a brick, obviously don't take in a protein shake and then go run, but make sure that you're getting in everything right after as well to make sure that happens. Hydration as well. Like if you're just profoundly dehydrated while you're going through this, it's going to be tough for your body to build anything useful. So just basic principle there. Creatine can absolutely help you add mass later on. It will add initial mass, but don't think that that's the sort of mass that's going to stick around after you stop using creatine. It can just allow yourself to carry a bit more water on board and increase storage capacity so that you can build more muscle mass. And then also don't go to bed hungry. If you find yourself, if you choose to not measure, because measuring can make all of us go a little bit crazy. So if you're not measuring, just don't go to bed hungry. That would be a really basic kind of simple thing to make sure that you're topped off enough,
And that's a super easy time to get that last little injection of protein too.
Yes, exactly. Also increase your sleep quantity and quality, get at least 8 hours. If you're not sleeping enough, your body once again, doesn't have much to be able to build with, doesn't have a long time to be able to make those changes that it needs to as you're sleeping. And then also, as long as it doesn't compromise your performance on the bike, as long as you're checking all these other boxes, you can lift heavier too. Right, Chad? I mean, you don't necessarily need to be some sort of power lifter athlete as a triathlete, but at the same time, if you're just doing body weight sort of stuff and you want to add muscle mass, I mean, lift heavier.
Yeah, definitely lift heavier than body weight. If you're looking to add muscle mass, then I would veer more towards adding greater volume. So more repetitions, more sets, just more weight lifted over the course of the workout, not necessarily in individual lifts.
Mm-hmm. Ivy, do you have anything that you'd want to add on this one?
Oh, yeah. I miss Pete. this is... reminiscent of some conversations that he and I had about protein specifically. And I can't, kind of reading what Damien described eating throughout their day, like they may be vegan or vegetarian, but that doesn't mean that there are plenty of places to get your protein that aren't from meat, like nuts and chickpeas. I'm just remembering conversations with Pete about how important it is to get your protein from different sources too. Mm-hmm. Like a solution to this isn't for Damien to slam 6 weird protein drinks a day, like snacks can consist of more nuts and beans and chickpeas and can incorporate like more tofu into your dinners and things. But yeah, I think that variety for me, variety in protein sources helped what I consider to be better absorption. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a super, having a varied micronutrient profile goes a long way to helping you out. Macros get all the attention, but micros are just extremely important. So Simon's question, this kind of dovetails. So we just talked about a pro athlete and what they should be taking in, and it's a very different scale than what a lot of us need to be worried about, right? Simon says, over the last 18 months, like many others, I've been working from home and have just changed jobs, which means I'll be working from home indefinitely. This is great, as no more commute, but I have worked out that I now walk about 10,000 steps less per day than I used to when I was in the office. That change has upset the fragile equilibrium that is my poor diet versus being reasonably active, and the waistline has started to grow. I've worked out, by Googling, he mentions, that 10,000 steps is about 350 calories per day, and roughly 30 minutes at 160 watts on the bike is also about 350 calories. So I've decided to start doing this on a daily basis to make up for the lost steps, unless I have a workout planned. Is this the best way to make up this deficit, or does walking bring different benefits? Even if I do go walking, Even if I did go walking, it would be in one longer walk rather than little and often throughout the day as before. For me, 160 watts is currently an IF of about 0.65, and it doesn't impact other work on the bike. So let me know what you think, from Simon. Chad, what do you think about this approach of him trying to kind of make up for those lost steps, that lost level of base level of activity with just doing a 30-minute easy spin?
I think it's a good approach. I mean, how you incur your caloric deficit, I'm not too concerned about. The fact is that the math at the end of the day needs to be in the negative column in order for you to, start to shed some of that weight. Do recognize that, as I've said a number of times, this is a lifestyle change. This isn't a temporary change. If the changes you make now get you the body that you want, you can't go back to the way you were prior to that. So anything you're going to add or reductions you're going to make in your diet kind of have to stick based on what it is you eventually achieve, if that in fact is exactly what you want. So you do this for the period of time that you do it, but if it's just this stopgap measure that helps you get there, and then once you get there, you return to old habits, you're going to be right back where you were. So my advice is simply that make sure this is something that you can maintain a level of permanence. It has to be part of who you are now. So whether or not you get it on the bike, whether or not you get it, maybe something changes and you can walk more. Maybe you decide some other form of activity is going to enter your lifestyle, or you recognize that you're putting too much butter on your toast and that's an easy 100 calories to cut out. Whatever it may be, just make sure it's something you'll be able to maintain.
Yeah, good advice. I think it's not like a bad solution, right? Timing matters too. You can get more out of this sort of stuff if you do it after meals. If it's like a light, spin, something like that, you can get more out of that. Just decreasing that sort of that initial insulin response that you get, that's going to pack a lot of that away by introducing some lower level of activity right after you eat. That can be helpful. I really love, like, after meals, I love taking a walk. That's just kind of like a a short, even if it's just 10 minutes, just a quick walk can really help. Just helps throughout the day too. So I could see that. But also looking at this, if you can fit in 30 minutes a day doing this, why not just look at extending the quality work that you're doing for 30 minutes? Like if you have 60-minute workouts scheduled, why not look at use workout alternates in Trainer Road and pick a 90-minute workout and instead do that? Doing 90 minutes of quality work, like, you know, within that 90-minute extension, that might mean that you do a portion of that extra 30 minutes at like a higher quality and higher level of intensity. But Simon, if your goal is just to drop the weight or to do all that stuff, it doesn't mean that you have to take an entirely different approach. You could just do longer workouts as long as your schedule allows for that, and that could be great. I don't know if it would be necessarily beneficial for you to, if you're like rolling out of bed and doing this, to pick like a really intense 30-minute workout that you're going to do. That can be tricky depending on who you are and your schedule. But if you can shift that 30 minutes around, I would just make my other workouts a bit longer. That's what I would do. You're going to burn more calories that way as well, if that's your goal. Your body will just become what your body, what it needs to be. So, and trust that your body knows the best path to that as long as you're guiding it with the right stuff. Ivy.
And that might be the best way to kind of fit into Chad's recommendation of doing something that's sustainable. You know, just like finding a workout that looks right and is accomplishing what you want and not thinking about, well, how many minutes do I have to do at this watts? And like, that's not a sustainable approach. Or, I mean, for me, it wouldn't be. It would be exhausting and kind of, yeah, emotionally draining too, to be constantly or on a daily basis, like wondering how I can make everything even out versus just doing the kind of work that makes me feel good that I want to do, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So finding sustainable workouts to do might be a better, more sustainable approach than, you know, doing this kind of math and deciding how much you can eat and how much you have to mm-hmm. ride to make up for it or walk, you know?
Yeah. And don't fall into the trap of malnutrition either. Like there's a lot of situations where a lot of athletes have been in this spot and they say, okay, so I'm just not going to eat, you know, that lunch, or I'm not going to do this. And it's really easy to do that. Don't do that. Give your body what it needs. If it's, you know, if it's extreme excess or anything else like that, you know, that's probably not healthy for us either. Don't just starve yourself to try to make up for this difference. You can probably introduce that level of activity in some way, as long as it doesn't cause other forms of stress across the board with scheduling and everything else. That would be good. So Simon, make those workouts longer if you can. That's probably the best solution that you can do and make it sustainable for sure. Chad, I don't know how in the world we made it through this episode with you still with us by the end. That was incredible with the internet.
Yeah,
made it through. we're going to cover just one quick comment, and then I wish that we could cover live questions today, but I'm going to keep it here because I feel like we've gotten lucky with having Chad with us this far, so we'll keep it there. Somebody says there was an episode about EPOC recently, which, Chad, can you define what EPOC is really quick for folks?
Yeah, excess post-exercise oxygen consumption. So that bump in your oxygen consumption that comes after you've done some form of exercise.
Yep. Typically also comes with an increased amount of calories that your body is using, right, to be able to consume that oxygen and to be able to use it. Mm-hmm. So it's like an afterburn is similar to what it's referred to in more, I guess, broader, more recognizable terms in that regard. He says, I think in the case of such a high training load like this athlete that we were talking about, Damien in this case, EPOC calculations should really be added to the daily calories, especially if weight gain is difficult. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, but the hard thing is EPOC is pretty tough to measure. It's interesting. Dr. Podlogar was just saying last week, Dr. Tim Podlogar, great follow on Instagram, that you know, being able to actually measure gas exchange rates and then extrapolate that out to BMR, like, you know, your basal metabolic rate or like a really a true level of calorie burn, he said, is just problematic in terms of when you're talking about calorie precision. It's really tough. We can estimate and we can see that certain markers are changing in the body, and that probably means that you're burning more at this time, but it's really tough to be able to actually measure true calorie burn. Tim, I believe, was saying that, or Dr. Podlogar was saying that, I think there was only one place that he knew of in the world, one lab that could actually get you close to that. And even then, he didn't know if it was perfect. So Yes. While in an ideal world, we could say, I'm doing this and then my epoch should increase it by this much. That's really tough to be able to measure. And once again, measuring is not for everybody. And I know a lot of people probably assume that we would suggest that, being so data driven, that everybody measured everything and get it down to a T, but I don't. That's a very individual thing, and it can cause a huge complex with food, and it can make an unhealthy thing become profoundly more unhealthy. So measuring is something that works for some people, doesn't work for all. And it's always, we're using a lot of guesswork when you guess that that Chipotle bowl is something that it is. So, all right. Thanks so much for joining us. If you are listening to this now, please share this podcast with your friends. Go to trainerroad.com and go sign up for adaptive training. It's awesome. It's going to give you the best season yet. I'm confident in that. If it doesn't, come talk to me and we can sort it all out, but please go check it out. It's awesome. So many people are getting faster. It's fantastic. It's cool. We're digging into a lot of data behind this, and we'll be watching the data over the course of the year so then we can get some better, more solid, reliable insights to share with you all about how it helps improve athletes. But it's profoundly impactful. Reduces failed workouts by over 54%, but we'll see what happens once we get into the real training season that a lot of people have. Might even go down more. So with all that said, thanks everybody for joining us. Go follow us on Instagram, subscribe on YouTube, subscribe on the podcast, share it with everybody. We'll talk to you next week.